You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hey there, everyone. Thank you for coming to this panel. First of all, let me just throw it out there. I'm supposed to be moderating a panel of bloggers. I'm not really sure how that's supposed to work. I mean, by definition, is that even possible? My name is Sean Garrett. I'm with 463 Communications. We're a communications firm based in D.C. I work in Silicon Valley. We have a specialty in tech policy communications, and which means we get to live in this world. And we make social media, new media, old media part of our lives. It's just something that we do. We work with companies ranging from Cisco to Skype to Disney to organizations like TechNet and NetChoice. And also work with startups. And our last panelist has arrived. My delay has worked. We also have a tech policy blog. You can look it up, 463 blog. But I want to do as little talking as possible and let our bloggers on the panel get right into it. And so the only ground rules for this panel are no presentations, keep pontifications to a minimum, keep it snappy, make it as interesting as possible. And so what I'm going to do is just ask the panelists to introduce themselves, kind of 30 seconds or so, and then we'll just get right into it. And the other ground rule is we're not going to wait around for audience Q&A. This is try to make this much like the online world as possible. Feel free to jump in. Feel free to raise your hand. Feel free to engage. Feel free to take us on a different tangent, and we'll ride with you. So let's start this off. John, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm John Sportacki. I'm at Verizon, and I'm on a tech policy blog panel. I'm kind of like a chum, and here to tell the sharks so you know how they're doing. I'm just kidding. Actually, it's not how I view the relationship back and forth. I'm more advanced than chum, but I helped edit and started and advocated and evangelized Verizon getting into this space with our own blog, Verizon. It's policyblog.verizon.com, policyblog.verizon.com, and there about a bunch of our policy people sort of espouse and engage the community through that platform. I'm active, semi-active there. I'm mostly behind the scenes editing, and I'm on Twitter at CZ, which is my nickname. At CZ, and please follow me there. I often extend the blog that way, and we're going to do more of that. So anyway, I'm at Verizon. I've worked on Capitol Hill. How many people here from Capitol Hill? I worked on Capitol Hill for about 10 years in the 90s or so. And so I'm anxious to do a lot of listening here like we do online and engage where it would be helpful.
Ajit?
Okay. Thank you. My name is Ajit Jawkar, but the name for our blog is called Open Gardens, which is talks about a pragmatic view of opening up the networks. Can you hear me, first of all? Is this loud enough? Yeah. I live in the UK. I was born in India. I'm best known for a couple of books, mainly Mobile Web 2.0, a lot of discussion about the Internet of Things. I also conduct a course at Oxford University. I don't actually work for Oxford University. I teach a specialist course at Oxford University. My business is publishing, and I'm going to tell you about three things about blogging which I think are quite important, considering I've been called a shark, which is interesting. but I think the first thing to do is that there's a lot of bloggers. I think bloggers can be classed into three types. There's firstly the companies, essentially what TechCrunch has become today. Secondly, there's niche bloggers like me, who are really specialists in one specific topic. And in fact, I wouldn't even talk about games. I just talk about open source content, things like that. And thirdly, there's a whole bunch of noise in the blogosphere. The second thing about blogging is that it has become a very much decentralized thing with Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and so on. My personal view on blogging is that I think it should include a human element. It should talk about your personal beliefs. I talk about human rights, Tom and Jerry, which I follow, ZZ Top, a band which I follow. And I also look at other people's blogs very detailed. For example, I know that John was born in a place called Neskonsent in New York, which is a quiet working class area. So I have been searching
it's
for
Indian
prey.
For next, it's Indian for It's American Indian for next to the mall.
Good, that's nice. So I think that just summarizes my initial views on blogging. The three things I think I want to quickly talk about are policies for cloud computing. I think that is a massive, big issue, not been touched yet. I speak in the European Union quite a bit as well, and this has been talked about quite a bit. Second thing is about activity streams, especially when it comes to mobile, the whole cookie trail digital footprint discussion. And the third thing, what I call as the Internet of Things, to kind of take Web 2.0 beyond collecting intelligence from people to collecting intelligence from devices as they become more connected. That's really it's summarized.
Thanks, Ajit. We'll see if we can get all those in. Mike?
All right. So I'm Mike Masnick. I guess I'm sort of an accidental tech policy blogger. I started a blog which morphed into a larger company, and I started in 1997 before the word blog existed in any form, and so it was a blog before it was a blog. And I'm kind of happy that, you know, today at least blogging has become mainstream enough that for a while I was on these types of panels where it was sort of the AA meeting type of thing where, hi, I'm Mike and I'm a blogger, and then I have to explain what that is. But we've gotten past that, and it's gotten into some more interesting levels. But, you know, I really started blogging just out of interest in the technology world and trying to explain the technology world to other people. And that's really sort of taken a pretty strong policy shift over the past few years, just from the recognition that policy issues were increasingly important. And I'm, like Sean, based out in Silicon Valley, so I don't really like wearing a tie or a suit, but when you come to town, I guess it's kind of necessary.
And just to, I think, Mike, you actually, Mike writes for Tech Dirt.
Yeah, I don't know if I said that, sorry.
No.
But yeah, so that's all I have to say.
Thanks. Julian?
I'm Julian Sanchez. I'm going to get the plug up right up front. I'm the Washington editor for Ars Technica, ARSTECHNICA. I write the Law and Disorder blog there, as well as covering stories. I was a political reporter who wrote a lot about tech. Now I'm a tech reporter who writes about politics, which, as far as I can tell, is the same job, but the insurance is better, and I don't have to explain what ICANN stands for, which is interesting. So I'm throwing out a kind of general framing idea. One of the things the first thing I wrote basically when we started the Law and Disorder blog was that, in a way, unless you're really just talking about like gadget reviews, I'm not sure there is such a thing as tech blogging anymore, any more than there's such a thing as written word blogging or oxygen blogging, right? It's not like the John Perry Barlow like mystical walled garden of cyberspace anymore. It's just part of your life. So it's like everything is tech and, right? So politics is already tech and politics, always already, if you want to like. I feel like you're an undergrad again. But in a way, the compartmentalization there really just means focusing on one aspect of something that actually already permeates not just policy in terms of how policy affects tech, but the way we do politics.
So I think just for setting context here, I think it's helpful to know, when you look at some of the statistics of how many people read blogs and online sources of information versus, you know, old print media, or even the online versions of recognized newspapers, the statistics are staggering. Sometimes the blogs are 10x higher than what you would call traditional media. Just for a quick context, Julian, I mean, how many people read Ars Technica?
Like, I have no idea. I don't. We were saying this the other night. I've watched so many interesting writers just like lobotomize themselves with this like hamster slapping the lever for the pellet thing, looking at stats, that I have no interest in knowing how many people read anything.
So that's all very nice, but a lot of people read Ars Technica.
I'm sure my editors disagree.
I mean, when you look on a story there, and I mean, it could be the most boring story I've ever read, but you look down at the bottom and you see the dig totals on Ars Technica. Dig is, a platform for recommending a story. I mean, they're off the charts compared to most places. And places, I mean, I would die to have, and Verizon would too, have Ars Technica's readership. It's pretty amazing. And so would the San Francisco Chronicle, and so would the San Jose Mercury News, and so would the Washington Post. Mike, maybe to this point, you know, you have a very kind of, I would say, rabid following. That would be pejorative, but but I mean, can you tell us a little about who reads TechDirt and what the impact is?
Well, that's a pretty broad question. There are lots of people who read it. I don't know if the rabid following is necessarily representative of everyone who reads it. The thing about being rabid is that you're also very loud, mm-hmm. so they may. Overtake it, but we have a pretty broad audience across the board. From what I know, definitely a lot of people in the technology world. But we really try and not just focus on on just technology stuff. So getting beyond technologists, a lot of business people read it. We talk a lot about economics and finance as it impacts the industry and about innovation as well. And so beyond that, I believe we also have a bunch of sort of policy-type people who read it as well. But you guys will have to tell me if that's true. Mm-hmm.
CZ, actually, maybe two things I want to cover here in this panel as we get along. And again, feel free to jump in. I want to cover kind of the process side of blogging, kind of who these guys are, what they do, and what the impact is, and how they interact with this world. And then we also want to obviously cover policy perspectives. So we're going to kind of go back and forth. But, CZ, I mean, why did Verizon want to get in the conversation with these guys?
Well, I mean, the fact is the conversation is happening with or without us. So might as well at least have a platform for engagement, at the very least, and try to do it on terms that, yes, it hadn't been done before, but, is what the future holds. And there's a certain, and there's a certain advantage to that because, like I said, this conversation is happening with or without us, and I'm sounding like myself in 2004 and 5. Like, blogging didn't invent the irate commenter or the disgruntled customer or someone who has the troll. They've always been there. They always will be there. That shouldn't make us stay away from the platform. So we're there, and that helps us. I mean, we all have seen this, and not everyone understands it, but the fact is it's growing to be, like you observe with the traffic at some of the mainstream media sites. Mm-hmm. Used to be the coverage, in the New York Times, a story in the Sunday or New York Times was the start of a conversation that went on and boiled down to regionals, and the wires picked up, and now that's the period on the sentence. I mean, this is the end. And so if you're not... in this space, observing acutely, and hopefully with also a like-minded platform to sort of share back and forth, you're missing out on that whole, the whole event that's happened by the time it arrives in the traditional format. So
you guys, this may disappoint CZ or it may make him happy. I mean, is there any impact at all on the fact that Verizon is actively engaged in social media, new media activities? On what you guys write and what you guys think.
Okay, can I add?
Yeah, and absolutely, any one of you.
Yeah, I think the key here is that, first of all, there's decentralization of media. In mm-hmm. other words, that there are, I, for example, with Open Gardens, mm-hmm. follow Skype for obvious mm-hmm. reasons, mm-hmm. but I also follow Verizon for the Kindle argument, because mm-hmm. that is a huge, big mm-hmm. platform there. The second thing is that people will trust a person; they mm-hmm. will not trust a company. Mm-hmm. Therefore, to me, this conversation is more about John and where he was born and kind of where vacation he took, kind of thing. Yeah. And the extension of the company comes afterwards. Mm-hmm. This kind of Robert Scoble principle. Yes, yeah. you work for Microsoft, you trust Robert Scoble, and however way you look at it. And I think that is the big reason for doing this.
You guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely it helps. It adds, I was going to say for better or for worse, but in this case for better, a human face to a large company that often it makes a difference in terms of the way you think about it and the way you converse with it. When you're basically writing about a company that sort of comes across as sort of monolithic and not willing to converse with you, you end up, you know, you sort of personify the company itself, whereas when there's an actual human face that makes it a lot more human, it becomes much more of a real discussion, and I think a lot more interesting things come out of it because of that.
Cool. Yeah, I always find, like, reading the blogs that come out of big companies, like, it's sort of like looking at those, like, strange devices you see in the back of Wired sometimes, like, they'd have these, you know, some weird device, and be like, what is that device for? And you have to, like, look at its pieces and trying to, like, sort of do backwards induction to figure out its purpose. So I find them interesting because I find it interesting to look at what they're saying and think and kind of think back through it, because usually what's actually, no offense to John, usually what's actually said is not very interesting. Sometimes it's interesting in terms of what it reveals about what kind of directive they're getting, from the top within the company. Or in other cases, if they've got a really quick response to some kind of criticism, you think, okay, who gave them that early? So I find them a lot of the time more interesting for what you can infer from them than from what they say.
Yeah, and I mean, just as a follow-up on that, I mean, there are very different types of, especially on the corporate side, very different types of corporate blogs, and some are a lot more useful than others in terms of, you know, whether or not it's worth just looking, you know, sort of between the lines versus what the people are actually saying. And the blogs that sort of come across strictly as sort of PR vehicles, that's really obvious, and they're not very interesting or useful, and they're not worth following. The ones that actually you feel that the people involved with them have a real voice and have the ability to, you know, at least within reason, obviously as a corporate representative, to speak their mind, those actually have some value.
Can I add something?
Sure, go for it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the PR angle is very important because I've been blogging now for about 2 years, and I think you get a lot of interest from PR people, especially if you're speaking as much as I am. The key most people, PR people, don't understand is the person behind the blog may not be a corporate journalist. For example, they would send me something with an embargo, and I had to look up the word because I really did not know the first time what an embargo was. And of course, from my point of view, I'm a PhD student. I have various different personas as a publisher, but not as a journalist. And that is the critical point there. And of course, the narrower the niche, the more interesting it is. So from my point of view, I'm covering lots of Web 2.0, mobile Web 2.0, but not even things like Java games, which is a completely different value chain from a mobile perspective. So, yeah.
What are the other kind of really big differences between bloggers and journalists that are relevant to this crowd? I mean, one thing I know with Mike is that we once sent him an email saying, hey, Mike, you know, why don't you talk to one of our clients and he could brief you on this one subject. And Mike basically said that I really appreciate the offer, but I don't really talk to people. You do, but I mean, it's like I'm not briefed, you know. And I read, and I'm smart, and I go through all this stuff, but I don't need to have a conversation with someone about this. I'm pretty up to speed. So
yeah,
you know, a journalist would go, yeah, sure, relationship building, great. I get the background, and maybe I could file away a couple quotes.
But yeah, and I think that's important. I mean, it's the same point that he was just bringing up, which is I don't consider myself a journalist. I never considered myself a journalist, and I don't necessarily take offense to it when people say it, but I kind of try and correct them. I'm not doing this as a journalistic endeavor. I'm not, what I write is definitely my opinion, and I believe it's an educated opinion. But I look at the blog as really being a part of a conversation, unlike a journalistic piece, which is more sort of, you know, getting all the facts together and getting all of the information together and then putting the sort of final piece together. I look at a blog post as a beginning of a conversation, that I will put it out there. And if someone wants to talk to me, or be a part of that conversation, they have every opportunity to respond directly in our comments, which are totally free and open, not censored in any way except for blatant spam. or death threats, but that's another story. Or, you know, if they have their own blog or their own social media platform, they can respond there. And then the entire conversation is public and everyone is involved. And that's different than what a journalist does. And, you know, I don't think one way is better or, you know, it's just different. So I'm not so interested in, you know, as Sean said, I'm not so interested in getting briefed or talking to someone. I'll get the information that I have and that I see, and I'll put my thoughts out there, and then if they have something else to say, they have every opportunity to say it where they want to.
And Mike is absolutely right, of course, but, you know, there's a paradigm shift going on. Like, not a lot of people who have grown up, you know, who use the word new media because it's new to them, a lot of people, it's not new, it's just media, you know, look at the written word on an electronic screen like they would look at a piece of deadwood and say, oh, and this is the opinion of this reporter and that's the end of the story and I don't like it and, you know, do I want to file ask the editor to do a correction or a letter to the editor? It's not worth the time. I'm just gonna scream at my colleagues about it. And that's kind of like how it was. And so from Mike's point of view, it's like, well, he's starting the conversation. He might actually I'm gonna make this up, but he might use a little hyperbole or just sort of go with that conversation, make it more interesting to start and flesh it out to spur people who are used to this back and forth. And not everyone is there yet. Not everyone sort of sees and feels that, like, okay, well, if we're going to respond, it needs to go through 7 levels of clearance and da-da-da-da, like a letter to the editor of the New York Times would. So we're getting there. It's just not all there just yet.
I also thought this question was just weirdly framed, right? Like, the blogger is like one of these creatures in Borges's, like, you know, Chinese encyclopedia, right? You know, like creatures who belong to the king, creatures mm-hmm. who have yellow stripes. It actually doesn't make sense, right? Like, mm-hmm. blogging is like paper in the sense that it's just a place where people write stuff.
Right.
Some of them are, I am a journalist. I've worked for various magazines. I still do reporting. I make phone calls. crazy. And some people are and some people aren't, and people do all kinds of writing online, on blogs, on paper, and increasingly, I mean, if you look at the big blogs, or a lot of the big on the political side, at least, right, like, well, what are the political blogs people read? Well, a bunch of the ones at The Atlantic, written by journalists, The New Republic, written by journalists, Andrew Sullivan, ex-journalist, I guess still sort of semi-journalist. It's just a place where people write stuff, so talking about the distinction, I think, it's like saying what is a paper writer?
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive, right? There are an awful lot of journalists who blog or journalists who use blogging just as a platform. It's just a content management system in itself. But that doesn't mean by definition that anyone who blogs is a journalist.
I think obviously with the composition of this panel, one thing I wanted to demonstrate was, you know, especially with John on it, is that, you know, anyone presumably can get into this conversation if you have something intelligent to say. I mean, and that's the point. But you also have to understand everyone's coming at this with kind of unique perspectives and unique ways of attacking it. And maybe from that journalistic ethos, and maybe from I'm running a small business, and maybe from I'm an Oxford professor, or maybe from I'm paid by a large company and they want me to write this stuff. You know, that is the full panoply.
A quick correction. Yeah. You said if they have something intelligent to say, sometimes they don't.
True.
But they
Andrew Keen.
And they can still be a part of the conversation. So,
I'm Mike Nelson. I'm a professor of internet studies at Georgetown, mm-hmm. and I've been fascinated by this conversation, mm-hmm. looking at blogging versus journalism.
Yep.
But there's another interesting comparison, which is blogging versus the next generation of blogging, or the internet as a platform for
yep.
policy advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work on the Hill, and then the White House, and then IBM, and there's the impact equation. The quality of the idea times the number of people who embrace it tells you how much impact you're going to have on the policy process.
Mm-hmm.
And what's exciting now is to see things like Facebook, where good ideas are going out there, and people can put their name behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So 500, 5,000, 50,000 people can say, yeah, that's what I want. We have this new independent website there's several independent websites trying to help the Obama administration figure out what it should do. So ObamaCTO.com is just one of many that is trying to get people to vote on what they think is important. How do you see that evolving? And do you think there are ways that bloggers can become more powerful and have their voice amplified by getting people to sign on and say, yeah, that's it, I agree, rather than just having a back-and-forth conversation mm-hmm. where a bunch of people say, yeah, you're right here, I disagree there, but actually building movements around very specific proposals?
Anyone want to grab that?
Well, yeah. I just want to say, I mean, the key word there, I think, is evolving. I mean, it's hard to take a snapshot and think, okay, this is it. No, this is it. I mean, because it's constantly, I mean, every single time you turn around. So what's important is just sort of you know, Ajit has written about, you know, the personal, the branding and branding efforts. And that's what it comes down to, like, individuals, companies, whatever. You know, how do they conduct themselves in this new environment of constantly evolving, you know, ways we're being communicated with? And so you got to stick to your knitting. You got to make sure that, okay, am I being transparent? Am I authentic? Am I being credible? Am I being true to my customer? Am I owning my mistakes? Am I trying to fix them? Am I doing the things that the community would require as table stakes? And then, okay, well, there's a great new idea here. Someone started a website, you know, that bashes me or likes me, and I want to learn from that and interact with that on whatever new terms might exist. You know, that's one of the ways I like Twitter and been on it for a while. It's because it's just sort of, my bio there is, you know, I'm a social media lab rat. Because I see it as an evolving process, how you're having these personally branded ways to communicate individually with people. And I think it's shifting. I think what's important, though, is to sort of, again, who you are, and not worry as much about who they are, and then interact with them however they see fit when the time comes.
Do you see any places where social media is being used particularly effectively for policy advocacy, where people are coalescing around?
Well, YouTube would be the obvious one, but I think the point is very important, because it's more of a general concept that I think what this object, this idea of the social media object, in other words, that you have a conversation, you have something, and then you deploy it outwards. You throw it out as much as you can. I think that is the classic difference between Yahoo and Google. Yes, I mean, Yahoo, or everybody wants to come here. Google says, go away. Put out links, yes? And as a blogger, that's what you do. I mean, it doesn't make logical sense, because you tell people to go away, or you go somewhere else. But I think it brings you into a network who you normally don't have. And I use this quite often in my validation of my ideas, that you throw it out at completely different people, groups of people who will never have heard of you, and you come up with a perspective which is completely different.
I mean, there are a few things there, and one of the things that I would sort of caution against is that sometimes people do overreact a little bit, and they'll sort of put up an online petition, and they'll get, you know, all these different people to sign it, and they'll think they've done something, and they haven't, right? And those kind of go nowhere. So there's a difference between, you know, just sort of getting an idea out there and getting people to sign on, and actually making it effective and useful in doing stuff. But I think, you know, just the idea that any of these things, any of these platforms, no matter what they're called or however they're structured, are just a form of communication, of getting ideas out there. And as you said, I mean, the more that the idea is out there and the more that it spreads, the more effective it can be for creating change, whether it's direct or indirect. And, you know, there are times where I'll write about something or write about, you know, a policy initiative or something or a legal decision and talk about why I don't think it's very smart. And I'll have people complain and say, well, you know, basically don't talk about it, change it. And it's like, well, I think I am, right, by talking about it, you know, and whether or not it's, you know, whether or not it's directly from that. I mean, there are things that I've written and that I've said that I've later seen, you know, and whether it came directly from me or through another path or literally someone else just came up with the exact same idea, which is probably very highly likely, you see those ideas show up and pop up in other places, and that's exciting, and that's leading to real change, even if it's not like, oh, I set up this petition on Facebook to create that change. It is actually happening.
A lot of the petition breaks through the barrier. It gets people in the mainstream media to know this.
Sure. And you know, there's...
The senator might pay attention to 10,000 people.
And this is a non-U.S. example, but up in Canada, Michael Geist, and I don't know how many people sort of paid attention to this, but you know, last year Canada tried to pass a new copyright bill. I think it was C-61 is how it was designated, and it was sort of a DMCA-like law for Canada. And Michael Geist, who's a law professor in Canada, basically turned what, you know, was a sort of boring policy issue, you know, oh, we're sort of adjusting copyright law, into a major issue that he just, you know, he used every social media tool that he could find, and it just built up steam. And, you know, with Facebook, they had, you know, it was like, within a day, they had 1,000 people, and then within 2 days, they had 10,000 people, and then, you know, 30,000 people. It was just going so rapidly that the mainstream press, you know, really had to pay attention to it, and they started asking questions of the politicians who were introducing this bill, and it actually got the bill effectively killed, at least for last year. It'll come back at some
just
point.
Two very quick general points. First, just really, really, public choice 101, right, is that the balance of power in coalitional interest group politics is a function of transaction costs, right? You have, right, the old saw, right, is like dispersed... dispersed costs, concentrated benefits is why, like, you know, you can get a lobby for a massive subsidy that has a low cost spread across a huge population. So the interesting thing to me is the way the ease of forming groups, or the change in the level of ease of quickly forming groups, allows coalitions to arise that had previously essentially been bound to be shoehorned into, you know, one of two large party institutions or some other big existing organization because the transaction cost barriers were too high. So I think the Get Pfizer Right thing, the protest that grew up on mybarackobama.com, and out of that was a really interesting case where you had both major parties essentially having agreed that they were in favor of more aggressive surveillance, you know, fewer restrictions on surveillance. And then you had people first within the Obama campaign saying, wait, no, we don't like that. And then you had them hooking up with the Ron Paul people and with civil libertarian Republicans who weren't happy with that. These were people who, like, just would spit at each other if they had passed each other on the street normally, but found they had something in common and found that they continued to have something in common when the bailout came, this kind of, you know, anti-establishment populist sense that was able to create a coalition that might not have been possible before. The other thing, again, super quick, is I'm actually really a lot more interested in the fusion of the social media stuff with, you know, geotagging and other kinds of mobile network computing. So I've been thinking about, you know, in terms of activism politically, right, it's really hard to get a bunch of people to stand in front of a store with crappy labor practices, like waving signs. It's really easy to geotag a place with crappy labor practices, so anyone who cares... and, you know, care is maybe defined by a relevant social community, walks by and says, oh, no, people I trust say, you know, this is a terrible place. You know, same thing, you can even actually, like, steal the tech that they're already using. There's, like, Amazon and a bunch of other companies have these, you know, you point something in a book or a CD cover or a barcode, and, you know, they do a little search and they figure out what the book is or the CD is and they spit it back at you. Well, okay, they're already doing that for you to make it easier to sell you stuff. But an activist could really easily hijack the service that they're already providing you with, you know, again, some kind of further social tagging that says, hey, these guys test on animals. Hey, these guys, you know, pollute horribly. And I'm really excited to see what the next stage of that is, although that's probably a year or two away.
Bob Kramer with CompTIA. And I'm actually fascinated because of the fact that you sort of run very interesting parallels between advocacy and blogging now. Mm-hmm. And sort of talked about the amplification of advocacy through social networks.
I didn't interrupt you, because there's always been a fallacy of journalism. Of course it's advocacy. I mean, you're advocating truth, you know, whatever version of you believe in. I mean, so it's just logical, and like all blogging sort of calls it what it is. Sorry.
Well, no, that actually leads right into what I was going to ask about, and that's getting back to this comparison between journalism and blogging. Mm-hmm. And that is, we were talking a little bit earlier about how some of you consider yourselves journalists and others of you, or at least if you started off as journalists and others of you don't consider yourselves journalists. Some of you, I assume, consider yourself professional bloggers, or is that an oxymoron? Is there no such thing as a professional blogger beyond the fact that some people could derive income as bloggers as opposed to not? And for journalists, there is a professional code of ethics that goes along with being a journalist. And usually there is a line that one draws along that one can be an advocate for as a journalist, but there are strict things one can and cannot do along the lines of advocacy as a journalist. Does that apply to blogging?
I think...
And should there be a code of ethics that goes along with blogging is, and who develops that, or does it develop it organic? Does it develop itself organically?
Yeah, I think, and there certainly have been efforts to create like a code of ethics for blogging, which I think generated a lot more, complaints than anything actually useful. The nice thing about sort of, if you think about it, and I don't really like this term, but in this case it might be accurate, the concept of the sort of marketplace of ideas, it sort of takes care of itself. People who are unethical in some way or another are generally called on it, and it becomes aware, and it hurts your reputation. And the most important thing that you have in doing any of this stuff is your reputation. And if you're going to blow that reputation by acting unethically in any way, shape, or form, that's going to come out, and it will hurt you. So it sort of becomes a self-correcting issue where you don't need an official set of policies, and these are the ethics rules, and are you obeying 23 section C, whatever. It sort of takes care of itself.
I'd like to add a little
sure.
bit to this. I totally agree with this concept that in the end it kind of looks after itself by correcting itself. If you think about someone asked, I don't know where this was, somewhere in Europe, was that which is the channel you trust most? And apparently the answer was YouTube. And the reason why it was YouTube is because it has completely different perspectives from different people, and they're opposing perspectives at the same time. For example, in the UK, we have the BBC, which is the most renowned, most respected kind of journalistic place. But the BBC did a series on a cult. Now, I don't want to talk about which cult it is, but they had this. They followed this guy all over with this camera, and they're recording him, they're posting his thing, etc. What actually was happening was that group was also recording the BBC journalist. And what was interesting is the things which he had edited out, they put in YouTube. And when you look at the big picture, you realize that the BBC guy had clearly lost it. He had completely lost it at certain times. And if you Google this, you will see this very quickly. I don't want to name what cult it is, but it is quite interesting that they were able to provide a perspective which would have been completely edited out had it not been for YouTube. Therefore, to me, that is completely reinforcing the point.
Again, if anyone has questions, feel free to jump up and shout out. Moving quickly to policy, because these guys generally don't like talking about themselves and their blogging practices. They mostly talk about policy issues. What should we be thinking? Your readerships have some particular points of view. I should say that when I was looking through the bios of these guys and talking to them, I was struck by the fact that these three over here are all basically quasi or actual libertarian types. So, modify appropriately. But what should we be really thinking about this year in terms of tech policy this conversation, the conventional wisdom conversation.
Gold standard. No.
Yeah. what might we be surprised by, and what do you expect from the Obama administration? And sharp, fast, quick. Go.
What I would think I would expect from something is, I think what was fascinating was the previous two discussions in the morning, especially from the secretary from Virginia. I think this building a government of the 21st century is a classic. I think there is this whole concept of reengineering what we take for granted, and having a two-way conversation with the government is exactly what I would expect. I think there will be mistakes. There's no doubt about it. There are too many high expectations of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there will be mistakes, and there will be things which will go, but I think it is a trend.
I think we're moving beyond it as a theory and actually to reality, which was the thing I took away this morning. Mike?
It's a tough question to answer. I mean, I think the things that are most important to me, at least from a general perspective, is just the entire concept of enabling innovation, and how do you structure policies that actually enable innovation as opposed to hinder it? And I get the feeling that a lot of policies that people think enable innovation actually end up doing the reverse. Or at least they drive innovation in a certain direction, which might not be the best or most efficient or overall best policies for the wider economy and for innovation as a whole. So I think that's the key to me, and that's sort of a step back position, you know, look at the wider issues and how they how any policy distorts or shifts the incentives for wider innovation.
Yeah, I was interested. I saw Reid Hunt speak at the New America Foundation a couple of months back, and as a sort of former FCC chairman, Reid Hunt, of course, acting as a surrogate for Obama. And I remember asking, I said, well, you know, on your site, of course, you have this sort of boilerplate about IP policy, and, you know, we need, it's like the Goldilocks IP policy, right? Like, well, we need to recognize that we don't want to restrict innovation, but still provide enough protection to provide incentives, and we just, right? And I said, well, okay, that's great. And so we know all the ways that IP policy has gotten more punitive and more stringent and there's longer terms. So, you know, the other side of the Goldilocks, right, is there any place where an Obama administration would roll it back because it's gone too far in some direction? And it was kind of bizarre because he launched into a talk about how we need to better protect our copyrights overseas. And it was just like, he's like, he just couldn't think of one. It was like Sarah Palin trying to name a newspaper, like nothing. So that was unfortunate.
I think related to that, there are certain issues, and IP policy is certainly one of them where, and I'm very opinionated on this subject, but where I think that people have sort of this impression of, this sort of superficial impression of what it means and what it does. And so they come back with, whenever you bring up that issue, the response is always the same thing, which is, well, we need balance. And you know, I've sort of come to the point that whenever I hear someone say, we need balance, I interpret that as, we're going to screw everybody over. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. And I think that there are ways that if you start to look at any policy where it comes out that you need balance, if that means you're not looking at it closely enough, and that if you look at it more closely, there are ways to structure policy initiatives that actually tend to benefit most people as opposed to hurting everyone.
So who, and since this is the Congressional Internet Caucus, who now in Congress should we be looking at for leadership here? Who really gets it from your perspective consistently? You know, you may not agree with them on all issues, but at least they come from a foundation of understanding kind of, you know, what the Internet's all about and how it works.
Boucher. Lofgren.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a long list.
Sorry.
Those are the obvious ones.
Yeah. Yeah. So can we get to three?
That's tricky.
Number three?
We'll wait.
I don't know.
Why?
I don't know for sure, certainly, but I mean, I think it sort of goes back to the point that I was just making, which is that these are pretty complex issues that have a lot of different variables, and traditionally, for the most part, they're kind of seen as, you know, sort of boring side issues as opposed to key, important, core issues. And so a lot of people's understanding of them is very superficial, and they don't even see any reason to go beyond that superficialness because they sort of figure, well, I have a good enough understanding of it. Yeah, you know, IP, it's important.
But we just talked to the first part of this conversation was about the process of social media and blogging, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, every day we hear new stories about Congress using YouTube and using Twitter and getting engaged with their constituencies with a blog. So it's not like it was 5 years ago when no one was using this stuff and, you know, members resisted even using email. They're actually engaged. They're using it. They saw the impact on the Obama campaign. So where's the lag?
Well, those are two separate things, right? I mean,
well, no. I mean, my point is that they're actually gaining and retaining value from using these tools.
Yeah, and so I guess that's a good point. Where people will the more that they do use the tools, the more these issues come up. I mean, there was the silly kerfuffle, I guess, in Congress over, you know, whether or not congressional representatives could use Twitter, which was sort of really blown out of proportion in a lot of ways. But there was this question of, you know, if you're a congressional representative and you're, you know, using any social media tools, how do you have to represent yourself? And there was some interpretation that, like, if you use Twitter, which gives you 140 characters for anyone to, you know, very, very small space, do you have to identify yourself and have, like, a whole disclaimer? And how do you put a whole disclaimer, I'm a congressional representative, and still have room in 140 characters to say something? And so I think the more that they use these things, they begin to recognize that the issues are more complex. And certainly with, the same thing with YouTube. There were questions about whether or not congressional representatives could use YouTube at all, because it's a commercial site and there are rules about, doing stuff as a representative of Congress on a commercial site. So I think, like, YouTube had to create, like, a special thing where there would be no ads or something. I forget exactly how that worked out. But there were issues like that that were raised that I think have brought up the issues a little bit so that people are a little more aware of them. But I'm not sure it's really reached that level of, like, wait, this is something that we need to rethink. It's always been like, oh, well, you know, this is a problem because there are ads on YouTube, so we have to fix that, as opposed to this is a wider issue that, you know, how do we communicate? How do people communicate? How do we as congressional representatives communicate? And those types of things. I don't think it's reached that level.
Also, I use and get value from my iPhone, but I don't know how the damn thing works, really. I mean, I couldn't build one or, like, put it back together, really. It fell apart. And as soon as I was like, what is it? As Nietzsche said something like, or Machiavelli was like, right? Like, we always, like, think more of the source of pain that's inflicted on us than pleasure. So, like, something that's working, which usually means, like, some 23-year-old has made it work for us, you know, that's speaking as a politician, you know, awesome. I don't need to know. And if I do, you know, get involved, I'm just kind of thinking of it as, like, a really tiny TV ad with no pictures. Whereas it's just sort of when stuff breaks that we start going, okay, how did this get here? Why does it work? What's the structure of it?
So we have about a little less than 10 minutes left, so if we got questions, feel free to
jump up. I think the GOP, which is way, way behind here, and saying things like, we need to start doing it in the Facebook, which is my favorite quote ever, is actually probably going to come out 4 years from now, and probably with, like, a better understanding of tech, and how to use the new media, you know, the stuff that's emerging now, because they know how broken they are, and so I think they're going to be learning a lot. They may you know, be like direct mail, right? Like, Democrats really innovated direct mail, and then Richard Viguerie and the Republicans owned it, and I think that's a possibility of that.
So I want to kind of end this on a positive up note, since we're in this era of change and considering next week and all. I was reading a post that Mike wrote recently about how he stays happy. Because, you know, we talk about nattering nabobs of negativity. I mean, that's pretty much, you know, most blogs, frankly, are, you know, so fairly caustic, aggressive, and negative. It's kind of what gets people engaged and gets people going sometimes. And a reader recently asked Mike, kind of, you know, you constantly see all this, you know, corporate cluelessness, you know, stupid policies, just over and over again, it's Groundhog Day. So how do you stay happy? How can you even write this blog? And I think others can jump in on kind of what motivates them from a positive perspective. But
yeah, so, I mean, my response, and you can read, it's pretty long, but basically, I mean, from a optimistic standpoint, I mean, I consider myself very much an optimist, and you just look at everything that has happened. You know, look back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. You know, I mean, the World Wide Web itself is, you know, is a little over 15 years old. That's incredible. You know, in terms of how far we've gone and how much has happened, in spite of all of the, you know, bad things and, you know, clueless corporations and bad policies and everything like that. And so, you know, one of the things that we see is that you can hinder advancement and innovation through stupid policies and clueless corporations, but you can't stop it completely. And so, you know, any negativity that comes across from me, and there may be a fair amount of it, it's really to try and knock down the barriers that are hindering innovation from moving forward, as opposed to, you know, feeling really depressed about everything.
I mean, I just take this general question: how do I stay motivated for blogging? Yeah. I've been doing this now for 3 years, and if you read my blogs, they are very large and complex quite often. So I think that there's two motivations. The first one is actually commercial, because my blog, actually the subdomain of my main site, the futuretext.com site, so it's called opengardensblog.futuretext.com. Now, if I ask you to link to my site, you will say probably no, but you will inevitably link to my blog. People will fight with it, people will forward it, etc., etc. And by doing so, inadvertently, they link to my main site because it is subdomain of my main site. I started doing this 3 years ago. I don't see, not a lot of people do this, but it's a fantastic way to get very high Google ratings. Assuming you're doing something which is useful, i.e. people will want to link to you in the first place. If they link to you in the first place, then they inevitably help promote your business. Second thing is the libertarian approach, what I said. I truly believe I am changing something, and I will come back to this in a very personal example. I grew up in India, and I saw the sort of rise of broadband in 92, sorry, the rise of cable in 92, 93. And it took about, the irony of it was it's bootleg. It was bootleg at that time. So what was people but going in the villages and doing this sort of thing? But what happened is the smallest villages had an aspiration. And they sort of started to grow and see what else was what is the Doordarshan, which is the government-sponsored channel. And suddenly everything changed. And 10 years later, this was fantastic. And I blogged about that, about Africa, to say that I see the same effect which mobile will do to Africa. And this was fascinating, and this blog was picked up quite a few times, and a couple of governments picked it up as well in Africa. But then they read the last bit, which I said that in Philippines, what actually happened was the government, the guys, people use SMS messaging to topple the government. And I said that corrupt governments could get toppled as well. That's the time they stopped linking to that blog, because they realized that what it really means is when you empower people is that you cannot predict the result and you cannot control the outcome. So that is...
Julian, any
drugs?
Drugs?
heavy drug use. Yes.
Thank you. CZ.
On that note, speaking of which, Twitter. You know, Twitter allows me to. It's a kind of like my secret, dirty little pleasure. Because I mean, I sort of keep to like talking about, and that is kind of cheesily enough, just the secret of life. You know, you stick to your passions. What are you passionate about? And that's what I talk about on Twitter. I talk about, you know, I'm passionate about, you know, geeky tech stuff, Verizon and Fios, that stuff I cover, and being a dad, and baseball. And those are the things that just, there's always a source of inspiration. If I'm frustrated, which, by the way, I also view as a motivator, because I naturally, if I'm not frustrated, I'm not doing my job, so... But you know, if I ever need a place to retreat to, I know one of those three things will make me be motivated again, and that's one of the things that I use.
Great, guys. I think unless we have any final questions, I think that wraps it up. Just know that go back downstairs for the lunch, and we will be honored with the presence of the president of Skype, and who will be giving a keynote with Representative Goodlatte well into the lunch. So we'll see you downstairs. Thank you.